Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him, Scott Horton. This is my show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Find all my show archives and interview archives and blog archives and all kinds of archives. They're at ScottHorton.org. Also, join up the chat room, ScottHorton.org/chat. I just signed in. Hey, everybody. ScottHorton.org/chat. By the way, for anybody hearing this in MP3 format later, you should know we're on live 3 to 5 Eastern Time at Liberty Express Radio Monday through Friday. Ain't that great? All right, good. Again, ScottHorton.org. Oh, also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. So share me and retweet me and help spread the word of the show. All right, good. Hey, guess what? Will Grigg's going to be on the show today. Yay, Will Grigg. I love me some Will Grigg. And he's a big guy. So that's a lot of Will to love. He's great, man. Will Grigg, he was always my favorite John Bircher back when he was a John Bircher. And then, thankfully, he parted ways with that organization back in, 2005 or 6. And has just become even more plumb-line libertarian than he ever was, which he already was pretty good. And anyway, you know, I might not have guessed this back when I used to read Will Grigg in the New American Magazine, that one day he would really carve out his place in the libertarian movement in writing stories about local police abuse. And local, not meaning local in his town, but I mean local cops all around the country. The militarization of even the very thought processes. The militarization of all the equipment and the tactics and the training and the thinking of the cops on the beat out in Mayberry, America. Out in Springfield there. In fact, I think on The Simpsons they should update Chief Wiggum's force and have Lou and Eddie running around in SWAT gear all the time, terrorizing people, killing people, and getting away with it. Just as like a side issue, right, on the show where it's not even a side plot, but just a thing that happens that nobody even pays attention to. Oh, yeah. Well, Eddie killed somebody again. You know, oh, well, don't worry about it. That's Will Grigg's beat now. He's writing about killer cops. And man, there's so many killer cops. And each and every one of these stories, which there's a new one every day, by themselves, they're just so outrageous. It's just unreal what America has become. I mean, hey, if you were a black guy, then America was always like this, you know. But I mean, for everybody now, it's a totalitarian police state. It's a nightmare. And it's fun to me, actually, to hear the protected, those who at least think that they're in on it and identify with power, talk about what hyperbole all that is. When just look at the Snowden revelations, everything that anyone ever imagined these guys were up to, they've been up to it. Oh, they got your cloud. They got to buy the short ones. And, it's fun to see Glenn Greenwald, for example, calling out these reporters who attack him and attack Ed Snowden and argue that, well, look, these revelations don't seem to indicate that the government has just been persecuting every blogger they don't like or anything like that. So they're just trying to protect us. And Glenn Greenwald, he always uses the same comeback every time because it's the right one. What else does he need? Other than, yeah, but that's because you're a tool, dude. That's what he said to John Harwood of the New York Times the other day. Over on his Twitter feed, if you go look at G. Greenwald and look at his tangle with Harwood. Harwood says, look, the National Security Agency tapping every one and zero on the planet hasn't revealed a single scandal yet, other than that they're doing it. So what's the big deal? You like to hype it up like it's a big deal. And Greenwald says, yeah, but that's because you write for the New York Times about how great the government is all day. What do you have to be afraid of? Nothing. Heterosexual, you know, married, white, male New York Times reporter whose beat is the greatness of the national security state. You mean to tell me that you're not afraid that they're out to get you? As well, you should not be. They aren't out to get you, John Harwood. But you know, there are a lot of people in America who are not favored like John Harwood. In fact, look at the AP and Fox News. They've had the government going after them. That's as mainstream as you can get. And they've been persecuted. But Greenwald's example the other day in his argument with Harwood was, yeah, but what if you were a Muslim in America? What if you were an Arab? And those aren't the same thing, by the way. Did you know that most Arabs in America are Christians? And that most Muslims in America are Asians? Isn't that interesting? Anyway, if you were a Muslim, you might have a lot to worry about as far as the government keeping track of everywhere you've ever been and whose cell phone was in the same room as yours at any time ever. And what kind of conspiracy theory a computer can spit out about some vague associations like that. Whose phone ever called whose phone, whoever called whose phone, whoever called whose phone. Just think about that. I don't know about you. Maybe I got a few more than average, but every name in your cell phone that you have saved in your contacts, and think of everyone that they have saved in their contacts, and everyone that they have saved in their contacts. Like that old The More You Know TV ad about AIDS and dancing partners or whatever, right? That's the NSA's version of what you're guilty of, who you're tied to and associated with. Police state out of control. For those who aren't the in-group. And really, even the in-group. More and more. It's hard to tell. I think John Harwood might be surprised about what the NSA has on him. Maybe not. Maybe he wouldn't mind. But anyway. Good old Will Grigg. That's his thing now. And you know, there are others, others in the libertarian movement even, who do great work on the militarization of the police. Like Radley Balco, for example, has this book out. The Rise of the Warrior Cop, which is really good. And the excerpts of it that have run in major media around the country, really great stuff. And I guess along the same lines, but Will really does a good job of putting you in the shoes of the victims of this. These regular, decent people who are subjected to what's really, right, the most violent end, or typically the most violent end, the lowest level of state power, right? The local cops. And it's the training. That's what it is. And this is something that Will and I have talked about for a long time. The rise of the SWAT teams happened in the 70s, 80s. I haven't read Balco's book. I don't know if he goes into this. But it's my opinion that the Waco massacre and the American people's consent after the fact, they're cheering for it, that was really the floodgate where they said, oh, good. Not only can we drive tanks around in American neighborhoods killing children and get away with it, but actually they love it. They love it. And so every federal agency and every state and local police agency in the country just started militarizing. And of course, the Pentagon started training everybody and passing on all their surplus gear. And it's on now. I don't know who can stop it. But it's interesting, you know, even the terminology, And I'm sorry, I'm not trying to blow the whole interview here, but you know the way they talk about sectors. Come on, we gotta go patrol our sector. Like we're all a bunch of Fallujans now. These aren't Americans in their neighborhoods. And you know, it's not an accident that the cops that patrol your neighborhood are from at least the other side of town. They never have these cops patrolling their own neighborhoods where people know their first names. Where grandmas know them and have known them their whole lives. They're always patrolling others to some degree or another. And why do you think that is? They might be less likely to violate their rights if it was their own neighborhood where they grew up. Maybe. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Rocky Mountain Miners at RockyMountainMiners.com. Ever wanted to destroy the Federal Reserve System? Now's your chance. New free market currencies are making our fake government money a thing of the past, and good riddance. If you want to mine new bitcoins and litecoins into circulation, you need a computer set up to crack the codes to the new coins. Get the prospector from RockyMountainMiners.com. It's ready to do the work right out of the box. Crack the equations, spend the money. Use promo code Scott Horton Show and save $100. Get all the info and get the prospector at RockyMountainMiners.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, the great Will Grigg. But I got plenty of current events for discussing. First of all, man, I love Dennis Rodman. And I got to tell you the truth. Back in the 1990s, when he was somebody that people cared about, I didn't care at all. I'm a skater, man. I don't care about team sports and stuff. I mean, I can't really say I'm anti-basketball or anti-football or something, but just, it's not really my thing. He was a media figure for a while, whatever. But I'm his biggest fan in the world now. This is exactly what we need. Private, real American diplomacy. You might have noticed, you told the Gallup poll in your super majorities that big government is the problem. That's right, government is not the country. Government is just the people who claim to be the rulers of everybody who lives here in the country, that's all. How in the world did they ever conflate those things together in a way that was meaningful for you? No, of course, the government, they're like an alien force of criminals who came to harass us and eat out our substance. That's all. They're the enemy. You think the communist regime in North Korea is the enemy? The communist regime in Washington, D.C. is the enemy. With all their sanctions, all their restrictions on trade between individual Americans and individual North Koreans. They're as bad as the DPRK. In fact, they're much worse. Remember on Meet the Press, David Gregory, I may have the media stars confused, one of these hacks said to Dennis Rodman the last time he went to North Korea, oh, well, they have 200,000 people in their prison camps. And Rodman said, really? America has 2 million people in their prison camps. Oh, derp. No, that's different because what? Duly convicted? Yeah, right. North Korea is truly a communist totalitarian dictatorship with collectively owned everything that is government owned everything and a horrible murderous police state. And starvation for just about everybody except the army and its overlords in the Communist Party, and that's about it. It's a crime against humanity, the existence of that regime, in every way. But so what are you going to do about it? Kill him? No. You look at, you know, Bush regime foreign policy. It was to take the perfectly good broken ICE deal, the agreed framework of 1994, and destroy it. I saw some hack comparing, don't make a deal with Iran, it'll be just like when you try to make a deal with North Korea, not worth the paper it's printed on. Yeah, not if you let the Republicans anywhere near it. Or the Democrats, for that matter. You know, Bill Clinton never lived up to his end of the deal. But so what? The North Koreans stayed within the deal anyway. It wasn't until George Bush lied and pretended that they admitted they had a secret uranium enrichment program, which was ridiculous back in 2002, in violation of the agreed framework and their IAEA safeguards agreement and non-proliferation treaty signatures. But it wasn't true. It was just made up nonsense by liars. Republicans, same thing. And then they created the Proliferation Security Initiative, which basically said they proclaim the right to violate international law and cease whichever boats they feel like on the high seas in order to prevent Iran from proliferating in ways that international law supposedly wasn't good enough to stop, which, of course, was also nonsense, and added new sanctions and threatened them. And only then, in 2003, they finally, under Kim Jong-il, only then in 2003 did they finally withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, their safeguards agreement, kick the inspectors out, and begin. They started up their Soviet-era reactor, which had been frozen and off. They started it up and started harvesting plutonium out of it, and now they have at least a half dozen nukes. They've tested three of them so far, and they've been partial successes, I guess. I don't know. But they're now a nuclear weapon state, where they weren't before. And it's the same Republicans saying, oh yeah, you can't trust countries that we've targeted for destruction to live up to their end of the deal. Never mind any actual facts surrounding any of these situations, but there you go. But anyway, what's the best thing? What's the only way? You can't regime change them, now they got nukes. There is no battle plan. Even if America dropped all H-bombs on the DMZ, which would be a bit counterproductive, they still wouldn't take out all those hardened artillery positions there. They have enough artillery to rain down hellfire on South Korea. And you can't just carpet the place with megaton bombs. Their bunker busters aren't enough to do it in a non-nuclear way. I don't know if they could deliver the nukes they've got to South Korea, but they could blow them up on the DMZ anyway, which would be bad enough for the Americans if they had nukes of their own. And so it's off. The empire cannot attack North Korea. That's it. Maybe the Chinese could organize a palace coup or something like that. The Americans sure as hell can't do anything. So what's the alternative? Assuming, like, the government of America, Republican and Democrat, you like to pretend that you care at all about humanity in prison there. All of them. You send Dennis Rodman to play basketball. You send Dennis Rodman to say, never mind all that militarism, never mind George Bush and John Bolton. If you're outside, feel free to go ahead and spit. I want to spit, but I'm in my house. I can't spit, but never mind that. This is America. Those guys, that's just the government. This is the country. What's America about? America is about playing ball with your friends. That's what America's about. A love of life and liberty. You send Dennis Rodman and his friend, and he doesn't just bring his friends, he brings the Harlem Globetrotters. I don't know if that's what he did this time. Last time, anyway, he brought the Globetrotters, who, if you guys have ever seen those guys, they really are magically, talentedly awesome. So, how do you completely destroy a victim of communist oppression's view of America? You show them the Globetrotters in red, white, and blue uniforms, no less. You send your symphony orchestra, you let them send their gymnastics squad, and we all become friends. Have soccer games, maybe baseball. We sell them stuff, we try to buy stuff from them. Wow, you North Koreans actually produce, I don't know, something Do they produce anything? We love that stuff. We want to buy as much of it as you guys can make, man. Hell yeah. Right? Save the North Koreans. Send the sports stars. Send the musicians. Send the businessmen. Drop all the sanctions. Drop all the threats. And yet, what do we get? Endless smearing of Dennis Rodman. Oh, you're undoing our demonizing job of Kim Jong-un. Yeah, well, what's your demonizing job of Kim Jong-un accomplishing? We all know he's a communist dictator. The question is, how do you devolve power from his grip? Right? The question is, how to free the people under his control? And demonizing him doesn't do a damn thing to accomplish that, does it? Oh, he killed his uncle. So what? The U.S. government kills people all day long. From Morocco to the Philippines, all day and all night long, they kill people. Kill them dead. You need to sit here and cry about Kim Jong-il's communist uncle who deserved to be fed to dogs for all the people he butchered in his life. Of course, that didn't even happen. It was just a bunch of hype. But really, geez, I can't seem to figure out America's government's media's selective outrage. It's almost like they care about death when it's at the hands of people that they want to kill. Otherwise, death is fine. Death is democracy, it's liberation, it's modernity. It's exceptional. It's awesome. Or it's, you know, completely forgettable. I think I mentioned this on the show before. Somebody asked me just a few weeks ago, war in Libya? There was a war in Libya? Yeah. It lasted for 9 months in 2011. And no, they did not send the entire 3rd Infantry Division to go and sack Tripoli. They hired it out. They did it, you know, initial Afghan war style, with air power and spies and special forces and hired Quislings. And yeah, they regime changed Gaddafi out of Tripoli, and it's been nothing but chaos and bloodshed since then. And it's only going to get worse because, of course, if there's a government in Tripoli, it only has one mission: to disarm all who oppose it, to take over the whole country. That's what it means to be a government. So you see the conflict there. A bunch of militias armed to the teeth. A lot of them jihadist veterans of the Iraq War and worse. And the central state as backed by the West, which has hardly the power that Gaddafi had. And by the way, just go back through the archives and just listen to the show from 2011 where I told you so. So what's going to happen? America is going to be pledged to the future of Libya from now on. It's a light footprint so far, but it's part of the genius of my really gigantic time window that I'm predicting here. For the next 20 years, we're going to be bound to the future, at least. We're going to be bound to the future of that country. You know, we'll stand down when they stand up and give them purple-fingered elections and... What are they going to do? Admit defeat? Let Libya split in three? I guess they might go with that. Send Dennis Rodman there, man. He might be able to work stuff out. Send the Harlem Globetrotters. Hey, all Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I apologize for the dearth of interviews so far this week, just one per day. I think the world is getting 2014 off to a slow start. Well, my little world seems to be.
But that's all right, because I like interviewing myself anyway. I'm good on everything. I agree with everything I say. I'm my favorite. Yeah, yeah. No, that's actually not really true. Either of those things. All right. Well, anyway. I should have said neither. Neither nor. All right. I'm Scott. ScottHorton.org. That's my website. ScottHorton.org/chat. That's the chat room. ScottHorton.org/interviews for the interviews. ScottHorton.org/show for the whole show archives. Yeah. Mm. And check out my Facebook page at Facebook.com/ScottHortonShow and Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow for my Twitter feed. That way you can retweet me and you can share me. All right. Okay, so now check this out for a subject. I got a new advertiser on the show, here on the Scott Horton Show. I guess we haven't finally made the deal yet, but pretty sure we're about to. So I'll go ahead and tell you a little bit about it now. It's cashintocoins.com. And in fact, I'm going to tell you about it by way of playing a couple of clips of Mark Edge from Free Talk Live and what he had to say about it.
Perhaps you've been hearing about Bitcoins. It'd be hard to listen to the news and these days and not have heard about Bitcoins, but you don't know how to get them. Well, I'm going to tell you. You go to cashintocoins.com. If you go there now, take a look, you'll see just how easy it is. I figured it out without ever having to get any kind of help. It's frankly quite easy. You just click on get coins, and I guess the one thing you have to have is a Bank of America, a Wells Fargo, or a credit union with shared branching somewhere nearby you. So that there's a resource that you, and a computer. You need a computer. Those are some of the resources you need to have in order to get Bitcoins. Frankly, if you don't have a computer, I don't know why you'd be getting Bitcoins, but I suppose it's possible. Cashintocoins.com. It's low fees there. They make it very easy for you, and I've done it. You can do it in just a few minutes. Cashintocoins.com.
So there you go. I talked with Mark Edge, and he explained it to me, and I think it's sort of kind of self-explanatory there what's going on. But you know what? I'm going to play one more of those. Let's see. Is this the same one again?
Coin was going to, you know, when it was down at, I don't know, 600 earlier.
Oh, yeah. Now listen.
This week, I think it was on a Sunday or whatever. So I had a bet with a friend that Bitcoin was going to, you know, when it was down at, I don't know, 600 earlier this week. I think it was on a Sunday or whatever. That it was, that we'd see it hit over 1,000 within 2 weeks.
Mm.
It took 3 days.
Well, now, is it over 1,000 on Bitcoin average?
No. I mean, and that's really an interesting question, is what is a Bitcoin worth? There's all kinds of different exchanges out there and all kinds of different ways to quantify it. It's at 1,032 at MountGox.com currently.
Okay.
You know, I mean, everybody can.
Mt. Gox always has the highest prices.
Generally the case. Not always, but generally the case. Yeah, you know. I expect you'll see all the averages relatively soon up over that. But that's just my opinion. If you think that Bitcoin's upwardly mobile also, then maybe you want to get some. Fastest, safest, easiest way to do that? Cashintocoins.com. They are, you know, they've been fastidious about making sure that they're legal in all 50 states. This has been really important for them. They're registered money exchanger with the U.S. government, and it's really difficult to find legal ways to buy Bitcoins. And a lot of people are concerned about, you know, the United States government coming after them or in some way, shape, or form. Not going to happen with cashintocoins.com. Go to their website. They make it easy for you. All you've got to have in town is a Wells Fargo, a Bank of America, or a credit union with shared branching. Cashintocoins.com.
There you go.
Bitcoin average has Bitcoin price currently at
right.
About
$100
a Bitcoin.
There you go. Mark Edge from Free Talk Live there talking about cash into coins. .com, new sponsor of this show. And basically, that's the deal. Isn't that great? You just go to Bank of America, Wells Fargo, or if your credit union, or not your, if any old credit union around you is a member of the shared branching service, which almost all of them are anyway, then all you got to do is go deposit money in these guys' account, and then they send you the Bitcoins. And I think you just take a picture of the receipt and send them a picture of the receipt from the deposit into their account, and blam, you get the Bitcoins. Wells Fargo doesn't care who you are. Bank of America doesn't care who you are. Banks don't care who you are. If you just want to deposit money in one of their customers' account, their answer is, by all means, we would happily accept your deposit. So, perfectly anonymous way to buy Bitcoins. And in fact, just a reliable way to buy Bitcoins, because one of the things that Mark Edge was talking with me about was about how some of the time you can't get Bitcoins. Nobody's selling. Well, these guys have some for sale, being the exchange that they are. So that's cashintocoins.com. They're going to be a new sponsor of this show. I'm really excited about that. And, you know, I'm no economist. Although I like economics, I'm more interested in foreign policy stuff, I guess. But I will say, you know, everything's risky and this, that, and the other riskiness. But I do believe that, as far as I can tell, Bitcoins really do have a future, right? They, you know, in a phrase, thought of everything. How to make sure that people can't counterfeit Bitcoins, and how to make sure that, you know, whatever the hell. More and more big businesses like Overstock.com and whatever are taking them. More and more the word is getting out that such a thing exists in the world. And there are a lot of countries in the world where their government's dollar policies or, you know, monetary policies are even worse than ours. And people are looking for a way that they can easily store the value of their money before government inflates it all away from them in the hidden tax of inflation. Money printing, counterfeiting. And so maybe somebody will come up with something way better tomorrow that everyone's going to switch to. I don't know. But it seems like there's a real future in these. And everywhere I go, people say, you know, when the price settles, it's going to be at higher than this. So I don't know. You know, it's really maybe a mistake to look at Bitcoins the way people make the mistake when they look at silver and gold as a way to gamble and make money in the market, when really you should just be looking at them as a way where hopefully you can save and save the relative value of the money that you put away before the Yellens of the world get to it. So anyway, you know, I wish I'd been really excited about Bitcoins back in the beginning and had a little bit of money to invest in them or something, because there are a lot of zillionaires now. And, you know, ever since I first learned about central banking, my first reaction was, well, why not me? It's a crime for me to counterfeit money, but it's perfectly okay for you and your friends to counterfeit money? That's not fair. I mean, what the hell? If it makes no difference to them, if Bank of America just creates a bunch of money and puts it in Bank of America accounts, well, why can't they put it in my account? We'll just pretend I worked for it or something, and it'll be great. I'll have, I don't know, whatever, $1 million. Give me $1 million. How come it's a crime for me to come up with $1 million that I didn't get justly from somebody else? But it's perfectly okay for them. It ain't right, and I'm jealous. So, you know, it's true. I mean, I guess in a way it'd be great if I just made $1 zillion off of doing what I do for a living here, but that ain't working out. So wouldn't it be great a get rich quick on a bubble thing? But that's kind of beside the point. That's not the real deal. The real deal is an alternative currency. The real deal is a currency with a ceiling on how many can ever be made. And one where seemingly the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, the questions have been answered, and more companies and banks and governments and institutions are getting in on Bitcoins. The Chinese had an overreaction, tried to ban them, but that's not going to last. That just goes to show you, you know, what a powerful argument lies behind them. So anyway, I'm going to learn more about Bitcoins. And I'm going to tell you constantly now about cashintocoins.com. How you can get Bitcoins. How about that? Cashintocoins.com. All right. So now back to talking about stuff. Kelly Vlahos has a great piece at antiwar.com today about the bogus surge in Afghanistan, which she kind of left out only for space purposes. I'm sure she's written about this in the past. She left out the part about how Obama didn't have to do this, but he did it for political reasons. He was afraid that if he ended two wars, the Republicans would call him a sissy. Instead of being brave and doing the right thing despite their criticism, he decided to be a little sissy and back down and expand the war. Funny how that works. Oh, boo-hoo. Sarah Palin said I was dithering on TV, and so now my tiny little presidential feelings are afraid that maybe I'll lose a couple of seats in the midterms over it. When, of course, the argument for doing the right thing was the right argument and was the easy one to make and should have made short work of any critics attacking from the right. You can't win in Afghanistan. Look at it like this. From a bird's eye point of view, it's the size of Texas. From a standing on the ground point of view, it's shaped like Colorado, the western half of it. And so, no, you can't win there. In the middle of Eurasia on the other side of the planet Earth from here, without even a port to send your supplies in, for Christ's sake. It's a fool's errand. Ask the British, ask the Russians, ask Alexander the Great. I guess Genghis Khan had some luck there for a while, but you'd ask the Soviets and the Russians. Oh, but the Soviets are no more. Anyway, Kelly Vlahos' piece is all about how all that hype about the surge is now deflated. No one buys it anymore. No government in a box. No change in entire societies. No counterinsurgency doctrine. Just extra tens of thousands of people killed for nothing. Congratulations to Petraeus and McChrystal and dear leader Obama. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. It's been a little while since we played TSOL on the show, hasn't it? It's the past and the future. All right. So now we got to talk about Iran. Man, I just don't know. I don't want to overstate things, and yet I would hate for the message to not really get through. I read a thing by Stephen Kinzer, author of All the Shah's Men, and the new one, Brothers, about the Dulles brothers. He wrote this great thing for Al Jazeera America that's just extremely optimistic about the brave new future in American-Iran relations. And, oh man, I wish I could believe it. And by the way, screw the government of Iran. The government of Iran is not the country of Iran any more than Barack Obama is you. Yeah, they're evil Ayatollahs and all that. They may as well be the North Korean communists. I mean, they have elections and all that, but still, to me, their power is no more legitimate than Kim Jong-un's. That's not the point of this. The point is that America has this completely ridiculous at this point. Whatever argument they ever had for it is just got to be moot now. It is preposterous that America maintains this Cold War against Iran. You know? It's been 35 years since they overthrew their government. It was their country, the government that America had created for them, a fascist dictatorship under the Shah Reza Pahlavi. They had the right to overthrow him. Not that his replacements necessarily had the right to replace him, but they certainly had the right to overthrow him. And for the American government to hold a grudge over that when it's their country. We expect them to not hold a grudge over the fact that they've been suffering under an American sock puppet fascist military dictator for 25 years. How dare they be so uppity as to overthrow him? But then we get to hold a grudge for, you know, going off 40 years over that? Does that sound right to you? And then meanwhile, look at it from the Israelis' point of view, because of course they're everything in this entire discussion. From the Israelis' point of view, oh no, Hezbollah on the northern border. Read the Clean Break Doctrine by David Wormser. What are we going to do about the Hezbollah problem on our northern border? Because, of course, behind Hezbollah is the Baathist Shiite government of Syria. And behind them, of course, is the revolutionary Shiite government in Iran. Call it the Shiite Crescent. Well, what should we do? Decided the ridiculously stupid Clean Break American neocons. They said we should get rid of Saddam Hussein. Wait a minute. Isn't Saddam Hussein the cork bottling up the Iranian Revolution? Isn't that why these very same neocons, and or at least the administration that they were all members of in the 1980s, backed Saddam Hussein against Iran? What the hell did they think was going to happen? Especially Paul Wolfowitz with his whole, yeah, we got to spread democracy to show them we love them so much and whatever. Well, who's the majority, Paul? Oh, yeah, no, they're going to love your Ahmed Chalabi. They're going to make him the dictator, and he's going to, you know, be pliable, and it's going to be great. It's like in your fantasy. So what did they do? When the neocons, a.k.a. the Likudniks in America, that's the right-wing nationalist party in charge of Israel right now, Netanyahu and Netanyahu's party, Sharon before him, before he made Kadima, but anyway. What did they do? They just added Iraq to the Shiite Crescent and made it bigger and more powerful than ever before. That's what the entire American war in Iraq was about, putting the Shiite Arab majority backed by Iran in power in Baghdad, and not just in power, but living everywhere in Baghdad, where it's now an 85% or more Shiite city after, you know, what they call sectarian cleansing, as the Shiite militias, the Badr Brigade, especially under Donald Rumsfeld's command, they went in there, well, and under Gates's too, under Petraeus's too, they went in there and they did the surge, which helped the Badr Brigade finished torturing to death the last of the Sunni resistance in Baghdad with drills through their skulls. It was a brutal war there that America fought for the Iranian side, because that's what the neocons wanted, because that's what the Likud party wanted, that's what Benjamin Netanyahu wanted, and Ariel Sharon. Good thinking, guys. And so now, what are you going to do? First thing, I recommend stop listening to the neoconservatives and maybe ask yourself, what would Henry Kissinger do? Henry Kissinger, which he's pro-Israel, but he's not a neocon. Well, what Henry Kissinger did back in the 1970s was he went and shook hands with Mao. So we're going to split you off from the Soviet Union, and we're going to make it okay that we lost the Vietnam War. Because who cares? We're friends with the Chinese now. Or at least, you know, frenemies. That's the solution, from the empire's point of view, even. That's the solution here. Iran is the giant power in the Shiite Crescent axis of Hezbollah that threatens Israel. So make friends with them. And then your enemy is neutralized. Sans carpet bombing. Huh, gee whiz, Scott, that's so reasonable. Yeah, I know. And guess what else, too? The major sticking point of why this can't be done is an imaginary nuclear weapons program that is in fact proven to not exist in space and time, but only in the imaginations of those who believe lies. Otherwise, what they have is a safeguarded civilian nuclear program that you don't have to worry about. Everybody already knows everything about it. You can read all about it at IAEA.org. And even where the IAEA conflates their expanded investigations or attempted investigations far beyond what's in the safeguards agreement and under an entirely separate authority under the UN Security Council resolutions, when you look at what's actually their job, they are beeswax, as the great Gordon Prather would say. Oh, the agency has continued to verify the non-diversion of any declared nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose. Same as always, over and over and over again. Hey, are they making weapons with their nuclear material that they have? No, they're not. Is there any indication that they are? No, there isn't. So you see how we could resolve this quite easily. Hey, you guys give up that imaginary nuclear weapons program that doesn't even exist in the first place. Continue to not have one. And we'll stop threatening you with war all the time. And then maybe Houston and Tehran can, you know, the capital of America, and Tehran can do some business. And we can all be friends. We'll buy your pecans. Is it their pecans? Iran doesn't produce very much, y'all, but they've got a few things for export. We'll buy it. And hey, we'll try to sell you junk, too. We got lots of junk for sale. And medicine. It could be done. And we're right in the middle right now of the all-important time frame between the initial agreement. Do we have an agreement that we're going to try to work on an agreement? Yes, we do. And you'll do these few confidence-building measures? Yes, we will. And you'll lay off a few of these sanctions? That's right. We'll ease off just a little bit. Okay, good. And then let's work on a final deal. All right, let's work on a final deal. This is supposed to happen this spring, 2014. You'd have a final deal to resolve the non-issue of Iran's nuclear program. And the beginning, the possibility of a major thaw in American-Iranian relations. We would have to de facto recognize their independence, but that ought to be okay. But it's not a fait accompli. I'm afraid that Stephen Kinzer is too optimistic. And the Israelis and their allies in America, especially the Republicans, but in the Democratic Party as well, are doing much. And I just caught the tail end of Harry Reid on C-SPAN talking about it today, and I missed exactly what he said about the new sanctions bill that the Senate is trying to put forward in order to sabotage the talks. And they're lying to your face. They are dishonest actors, 100%. Come on. When they pretend like, oh yeah, sanctions brought them to the table, so more sanctions will make them more compliant. No, they're at the table now, even if it's true, which it's not an established fact that sanctions brought them to the table. It's a much more complicated situation than that. But even if that was true, so more sanctions might drive them away from the table, you understand. And of course, that's what Chuck Schumer understands. And that's what Menendez and Kirk and the rest of these guys are trying to do. And in the House, they're trying to do it too. Eric Cantor in the House, trying to sabotage this deal. So I don't know if you guys are much for calling congressmen and political action and that kind of thing, but this might be one where you call to say that you support peace and oppose their efforts, especially if you got a congressman who might be on the fence about this or something, you know? Will Gregg next. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Scott Horton Show. Our guest today is the great Will Grigg from Pro Libertate. That's the website. Pro Libertate at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Welcome back to the show. Will, how are you doing?
Scott, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on the show. Good to talk to you again. And now, I can't talk Russian very good. That'd be the wife's area of expertise. So go ahead and tell him, Dr. What's-his-name, I presume?
Ah, you're talking about Dr. Raskolnikov.
Who's Dr. Raskolnikov? Yeah, that guy.
Well, there's no doctor of that name to the best of my knowledge, but I hung that sobriquet around the neck of one of the supposedly expert witnesses in the murder trial of two of the eight officers who beat Kelly Thomas to death in Fullerton, California, about, let me think here, it's about 2.5 years ago. It was 2011, July of that year. And there's a fellow by the name of Dr. Stephen Karch. As I understand it, he's a consulting cardiologist from Berkeley who has made a very handsome career as an expert witness and as a tutor for the benefit of police regarding such subjects as excited delirium and other exotic diagnoses that describe afflictions that descend only upon people who are being beaten and kicked and otherwise abused by police.
Oh, and yeah. That's one of those. It wasn't the taser that killed him. It was the heart attack that he had while I was tasering him.
Exactly. There are these propitiously timed cardiac events or other sudden seizures that only occur.
He had a brain explosion when I shot him. What's the big deal?
There's this bizarre inverse observer effect that he talks about here, where there is simply a time appointed to somebody to die who has a certain condition, and that condition may elude the professional scrutiny of doctors who are not as adept as he, at least that's Stephen Karch's perspective. Mm-hmm. And so what he does is he abstracts from these episodes of lethal violence the actual involvement of the police officers at the time. In the case of Kelly Thomas, Karch, who had never examined the body and had not treated Kelly Thomas and didn't know Kelly Thomas before he was beaten to death, Dr. Karch suggested that because of an alleged prior history of severe drug abuse, that the victim's heart had been left distended and unhealthy, and that he just happened to expire from a heart attack while he was being crushed and beaten and tasered by a thug scrum of aid of Fullerton's supposed finest. And the official rendering, the official verdict, if you will, from the coroner was that he died as a result of oxygen deprivation to his brain and to his heart because his windpipe was crushed and because his chest was being compressed underneath a burden of the better part of a ton of tax-subsidized suet. And to anybody who's burdened at all by honesty and who has a grasp of the obvious, the conclusion should be clear that there is some colorable connection between the violence inflicted on Kelly Thomas by the police and his premature death, that Karch was trying to say that because of prior drug abuse decades ago, that Mr. Thomas had done irreparable damage to his own body, and furthermore, he had probably done irreparable damage to his own brain and to his own mind, that he supposedly had a psychotic episode in which he chose to fight these police, and he was supposedly bowling them down like 10 pins or throwing them around like rag dolls, none of which is supported by the half-hour-long video that was captured by a local surveillance camera or by any of the plentiful eyewitnesses on the scene. they all described how this 160-pound man who apparently suffered from schizophrenia, who was living on the streets and who may have been a nuisance but was otherwise completely harmless, was complacent. He wasn't violent, but he did put up a fight once he was attacked by Officer Cincinelli, who was, along with Officer Ramos, the instigators of this act of gang violence. That once he was pinned down to the ground and being beaten and tasered, he put up a struggle because of the natural instinct one has to defend oneself against criminal violence. But I compared Dr. Karch to Rodion Raskolnikov from Crime and Punishment. Raskolnikov was somebody who flattered himself as being a world historic transcendent figure who was not bound by the moral law. And to establish this principle, he plotted to kill a really unpleasant older woman who was a pawnbroker, a very wealthy woman, not much loved by anybody, and who would not be missed. And he actually explained his intent to a police officer, as Raskolnikov did, and justified it in the name of the greater good. After all, if she were allowed to die and make provisions for her own estate, her money would end up going to a monastery somewhere instead of being devoted to the greater good of the community. So because she's going to die anyway, and there's a certain percentage of people who are just fated to die or otherwise be discarded by society, why not we redeem this somehow by having her killed in a way that will allow her money to be used to benefit the lives of people who are otherwise blighted by misfortune, and so on and so forth. His conceit in this instance, Raskolnikov, was that he knew that there was a percentage of people who are going to be disposed of, and so we don't really have to treat them as if they're full human beings. And that seems to me to be very, very similar to what Karch is peddling for the benefit of police departments and law enforcement agencies. It is a ritual now. When you see somebody who dies after a taser strike or after a chokehold has been applied or other supposedly non-lethal means of subduing somebody have been employed, one of the first things you hear about is the phrase excited delirium. And excited delirium, once again, is something you only see in encounters involving police violence. You don't see excited delirium being used as a diagnosis or as a cause of death in cases where the police are absent and somebody suffers a fatal heart attack or a stroke or something of that sort. But practically any time somebody is tasered and goes into cardiac arrest, they blame excited delirium rather than the fact that this man has just been electrocuted and that there are dangers that are involved in sending a voltage and amperage of that magnitude through a human being. And Karch has been at the forefront of this. He's been at some of these taxpayer-subsidized gatherings sponsored by the Bureau of I'm trying to remember the name of the specific sub-bureau there at the Department of Justice. I think it's the Bureau of Justice Statistics or there's some subdirectory of the Bureau of the Department of Justice that actually subsidizes these gatherings in places like Las Vegas and other redoubts of contemplation, where police gather together and they spend taxpayer subsidies and stipends, a lot of it going into the types of vices that they would probably punish in their hometown communities, in order to be marinated in the latest doctrines of qualified immunity. And one of the people who have been presenters at these events has been Dr. Karch. In addition to being paid $700 an hour to dispense his puerile certitudes from the witness stand during the murder trial there in California. And just today, incidentally, Scott, I've been listening to the closing arguments by the DA, Tony Rakakis, there in Orange County. And much to my amazement, and my delighted amazement, among the things that he touched on was the fact that a police officer does not have the right to dispense summary punishment. In other words, he was talking about what we sometimes refer to as contempt of cop, how that's probably the most commonly enforced non-statutory law that results in police inflicting violence on people. It's not that they have probable cause or that they have reasonable suspicion to treat somebody as a criminal suspect. They just don't like the person's attitude, and so they invent some reason to go hands-on and inflict some street justice. That's another expression that describes the same thing as punishment for contempt of cop. And what Rakakis is saying is that if police officers are going to be responsible and professional, they will investigate crimes and arrest suspects, but they can't simply dispense summary punishment. And another thing he said that I found remarkable for a prosecutor, district attorney in particular, is that you have the right as a citizen to defend yourself against excessive force from a police officer. That's the first time I've heard this said, at least in recent memory, by a prosecutor or a district attorney, that Ramos, as somebody who was not conducting an arrest but simply tormenting and mocking this mentally disabled man, instigated violence, which means he had no right to defend himself if Kelly Thomas decided to fight back. He actually said as much. He said the only way that the right to self-defense would apply to what Ramos and Cincinnati were doing is if they had backed off and tried to de-escalate the situation and bring an end to the hostilities, and if Thomas took the initiative to retaliate against them, in that case, he said, you might have a situation where self-defense would apply. But he cited from the relevant statutes in California state law dealing with self-defense and dealing with the use of force by police officers to underscore something I've been saying for at least 8 or 9 years now, which is that there is a natural right that inheres in the individual to defend yourself against aggressive violence from police. And that right includes the not privilege, but the necessity of defending yourself against unlawful arrest, up to and including the use of lethal force if necessary under the Bad Elf decision of 1900. So yeah. That's remarkable to hear that same
absolutely.
Kind of idea.
Yeah, I've never heard a prosecutor say something like that before. Maybe a retired one or something.
Exactly.
Hang on, it's Will Grigg from freedominourtime.blogspot.com. We'll be right back.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
All right, so welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Will Grigg from freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com.
And we're talking about the lawlessness of law enforcement, and in this case, the beating death of Kelly Thomas and the actual trial of the cops. And right before the break there, Will, you were talking about the prosecutor's closing statement. First of all, it's amazing that this thing came to trial at all. Then you say the prosecutor's gone so far to explain that cops are not supermen. They're just the enforcers of the law, and that all human beings have the right to self-defense, even from a cop if he's using unjust force. And so, you know, that really is echoing what you're saying there. That's huge that a prosecutor would admit that fact, and that's going to come back to bite the state of California in the ass in the future,
too. It certainly is. And assuming that we end up with a guilty verdict here, I mean, if the jury rules on the facts, there'll be a guilty verdict, but that doesn't always happen, obviously.
Right.
But if we end up with a guilty verdict in which the jury has been persuaded of the guilt of the officers by inter alia the invocation of the right of the citizen to defend himself against unlawful force by police officers, we're looking at something that may be a Copernican revolution in our legal system, because since no later than the mid-1960s, it has just been assumed, this is something that was done through administrative action, through bar associations, and by prosecutors working in their jurisdictions, and by courts, not by legislation. It's been assumed that what is called violent self-help on the part of a citizen being subjected to an unlawful arrest or other abuse by a police officer was impermissible, not because it was illegal, because, as I mentioned just before the break, the still prevailing precedent is a case from 1900 called Bad Elk versus the U.S., in which the Supreme Court of the United States said that a police officer trying to arrest somebody unlawfully is simply an abductor and can be dealt with as such. And you can have as recently as within the last 10 or 12 years, any number of precedents in local or state courts recognizing the right to resist unlawful arrest. But as a matter of policy, it's been assumed that you simply have no choice but to submit. I call this the rapist doctrine, which is to say, just let it happen, because if you resist, things will go worse for you.
And yeah, I mean, this is where we get to never mind words on paper. If you resist them, they'll kill you. So isn't it worth it to just go to, if you can get away with, you know, maybe just a beating and a few nights in jail and eventually a chance to talk to a judge, it, you know, presuming you don't get hauled off to Guantanamo or something, maybe it would be better to not, I mean, because, man, they got radios, too. There's never more of you than there are of them.
Yeah, that's actually, that's a principle that Edmund Burke was talking about way back in the 1760s, about how if he's dealing with somebody who's a common thug, then Burke would be able, assuming that he had the astuteness and the physical capacity to do so, he would be able to vindicate his own rights in dealing with such a person, unless that person acted on behalf of the state, in which case that individual and all of his associates would combine to bring about his ruin. And that's what happened with Kelly Thomas. You had two people start beating this terrified 160-pound guy, and within a trice, there were there was a diabolical host, if you will, pounding on him to the point where they literally beat him into an irreversible coma, beat him to death, in effect, right there in the street.
And,
not
Will,
because
look,
he had
I
done
mean,
anything wrong.
Isn't it right that he was just another bum that they murdered because they felt like it, but the problem was that his father was a cop?
Yes, that's another aspect of this that I wanted to underscore, is the fact that his father's a retired deputy sheriff. And that has a lot to do, I suspect, with the way that this has worked out. There was some political juice on the part of the family here, and that might explain why this case, unlike a number of others, actually found traction. There have been
He's an honorary human in a way. They found out after the fact that, oops, this guy had he was a made guy or the son of a made guy, and so you're not supposed to touch him.
It's the inverse of the corruption of blood principle. It's because his father had been part of the Brotherhood of Coercion that people were willing to listen to him, unlike the relatives of dozens or scores or hundreds of other people who have been treated exactly the same way, albeit not quite with such lurid sadism necessarily, in California and elsewhere. And there's another case that illustrates this again. This is another almost unprecedented development, and that's what happened in Atlantic City with the case of Officer Sterling Wheaton. Back in 2008, Sterling Wheaton, who was part of a little group that just loved to set upon tourists there in Atlantic City, arrested for no reason and then unleashed his dog on an individual by the name of Michael Trosso, T-R-O-S-O. Mm-hmm. And it took 5 years, but eventually there was a civil trial, and the Atlantic City government, municipal government, and the police department were found liable. But Officer Wheaton himself was found personally liable. In other words, he was no longer given the benefit of so-called qualified immunity, and he's been ordered to pay $250,000 in restitution, half of the $500,000 settlement, to Mr. Trosso. And that's the first time, once again in recent memory, that a police officer has actually been held personally liable for an act of criminal violence. Now, here's the kicker. Michael Trosso was not just another black tourist in Atlantic City, but he was a deputy state attorney general in the state of New Jersey. In other words, it just happened that you have this individual who had some political clout, who was on the receiving end of what goes on every single day, no doubt, in Atlantic City and elsewhere. And so I applaud the precedents that are being set here, and I do have highly qualified optimism that these may have a tonic effect on what's going on across the country, but it still remains a question of your status in our supposedly small-R Republican society where the law is supposed to be king. And you mentioned the lawlessness of law enforcement, Scott. One of the things that people don't understand is the elemental paradox of what is called law enforcement. In order for them to enforce the law, they have to violate it, because the paramount law in all human action is the law of non-aggression. And anytime you're involved in aggression, you're breaking the law. And so the quotidian corruption of police officers who are parking in handicapped parking spaces or running stoplights or otherwise, you know, conspicuously violating these positivist enactments that we would be punished for violating, that's of a piece with what they do professionally. What they do professionally as a caste is they systematically violate the non-aggression principle. And I'm hoping, and this last year, as a matter of fact, has given me a little bit of cause for optimism on this front in terms of the philosophical revolution happening in this country. I'm hoping that this is going to be the year where a huge number of people in this country start examining police as from the perspective of what it is they're doing relative to the natural law, to the law of non-aggression. Mm-hmm. A couple of days ago, and I wrote about this on the Rockwell's blog, I believe it was on Sunday, I picked up a young couple who had been stopped by the police here in Payette. They were in their early 20s. They were visibly, on very brief examination, I recognized as looking at young adults, but they were stopped by a cop, and when I picked them up, they had been walking on a very chilly morning. I drove them over to Ontario, Oregon, which is just a few miles away from here. I asked why the cop had detained them, and they explained to me, well, the cop said that we looked like juveniles, and he thought we might be runaways. I said, it seemed to be obvious that you're in your 20s. You know, he's a trained observer. I'm supposedly not a trained observer, but it was obvious to me that you were not juveniles. But even if you were juveniles, you're stopped for walking on a public street in broad daylight on a Saturday morning. Now, once again, there's no probable cause. There's no reasonable suspicion. He was conducting essentially a stop and frisk here in the city of Payette. One of the things the young man in this couple said to me when I mentioned what I did is that half the internet now is talking about police abuse. And he's exaggerating perhaps very, very little, because over the last several years, owing to the decentralization of information gathering and distribution, we've been having all these conversations everywhere except through official channels, and it is having a measurable impact on the way people perceive what is being done. Mm-hmm. People now are willing to admit that the police are a problem, and they're a frequent problem, and that the aggression of police is something that's become a real societal crisis. I'm hoping people make the philosophical connection here to the fact that what they do as a matter of job description is violate the non-aggression principle, and they need to ask themselves, by what right do people claim a license to commit aggression against other human beings? Why do we tolerate that state of affairs? Because as a country, we didn't always do that. This is a fairly recent development in the broad scope of the history of American society, and it's by no means set in stone that it has to continue this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that, I don't know how much, you know, little d democratic power the people of the country really have to change it, but certainly the sentiment is changing. There's no doubt about that if you just read, mainstream newspaper editorials on the subject that, like, hey, maybe Balco's right, that this is going a little too far, y'all. And that's a really refreshing change, especially considering all of the endless TV propaganda about how essential these people are to our minute-to-minute security, you know?
Yeah, and they're still, I think, cruising on that social momentum. There's a program coming out on NBC in, I believe, a couple of weeks that basically glorifies this gang unit in Chicago that was nothing more than the apex gang in the city's underworld. The difference is it was organized and funded by the Chicago Police Department. You know, basically, they're valorizing and they're holding up as role models the people who were involved in the torture cases over the last 20 or 30 years. The Don Berg's case, if you're familiar with that cretin and his cronies.
They're in desperate straits. They don't know what else to do. They can't deny it anymore.
Yeah, so they're turning it into a made for a primetime TV drama on the assumption that there's an audience out there. And I don't know, outside the Fraternal Order of Police, I don't know what demographic they're targeting here, because I don't think that people, even those who become inured to police misconduct by watching propaganda shows like Cops and the like, are going to make a hero out of this guy. Then again, I was wrong about Vic Mackey. I thought that The Shield was going to be something that most people would recoil from because of the fact that you're dealing with such an aggressively amoral and despicable human being. And unfortunately, he became somewhat of an anti-hero. You know, back before Walter White, there was Vic Mackey. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the temper of our conversation as a country is changed now. And we've reached saturation point, many of us in any case, with what's happening and the fact that there is impunity on the part of most police officers who misbehave. So I hope this is the year that things change for the better.
Me too. Thanks, Will. I sure appreciate your time on the show, as always.
You bet. Thank you so much, Scott. You take care.
All right, but that is the heroic William Norman Grigg. Will Grigg. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. He is the essential chronicler of police abuse in America. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show. Ain't Will Grigg great? He should be a defense attorney, that's what he should be. He'd whoop any old prosecutor. He should be a prosecuting attorney is what he should be. A district attorney. He'd prosecute any old cop all day long. That'd be great. Yeah, well. You know what he really is? A great writer. A brilliant one. Freedominourtime.blogspot.com for his great blog, Pro Libertate. And also, buy his book. Buy his book. It's called Liberty in Eclipse. Liberty in Eclipse, and it's great. Okay, good. All right. One thing's that, yeah, I was going to get a word in edgewise, but I decided, no way, why am I going to interrupt this guy anymore? Not that I didn't interrupt him at all, but there's got to be a limit on it, Scott Horton. Jeez. So what I did was I didn't interrupt to say that part of what we have going for us with other than, like he talked about, all the social media and everything else, portraying an accurate reality to people about just how dangerous these guys are to us and making people want to see a change about it. Part of that is that we're benefiting from having the Democrats in power. Because then that makes it, doesn't really make a difference for the liberals or the left. There's pro or anti-cop as they're ever going to be on the scale between liberal and commie, and they're somewhere, you know, the further to the left you go, the more they're going to hate the cops and all that. That's going to pretty much be a constant. Yeah, it gets worse when Democrats are in power, but marginally, they're pretty bad anyway, really. But conservatives, man, when Bush is a president, oh my God, the conservatives worship cops. Jackbooted thug. They don't remember it was G. Gordon Liddy that called the government that for murdering the Branch Davidians. They say, you can't say that. You can't criticize a cop at all. Don't you know it says in the Bible, shut up. Government is awesome and it can do whatever it wants. It's right there in Romans 13. Cops can kill whoever they want. Your job is to lick their boots. They are our protectors, our idols we worship. They have a really hard job, oh, which means that good luck if you got a single Republican on a jury of yours. Oh, whatever the cops say must be true. Here's another thing I was going to work in edgewise but decided not to, was about the juries. He was mentioning the jury in the case of Kelly Thomas here. Is that jurors will just make up stuff to explain to themselves why it is that the cops must be telling the truth. You know, it's funny, what the cops said up there, it didn't really make any sense. Unless, and then they just fill in the gaps to try to make it make sense. Like on TV, you know. And I actually, somewhere I have the quote, but I don't have the ability to pull it up real quick, do I? Oh, you know what, I might. Let's see if I can find it. And now this is an extreme case. Let me see if I can find it. Well, I'll tell you about it anyway, even if I can't find it. It's a juror from the McVeigh trial. Now, I believe
that McVay was guilty. See, it's not in here, man. Oh, you know why? It's in the wrong folder to be on there. Nah, I got my OKC clips around here somewhere anyway. Don't worry about it. Point being, the juror in the McVay trial, which he was guilty, but the government didn't prove that. Because to prove that, they would have had to talk about all of his friends. And about how the FBI knew all along what was going on, and then somehow they didn't stop the gigantic bomb from killing 169 people. So they didn't want to talk about all that. So they never really got around to proving their case against McVay. They paraded witness after witness to talk about how sad they are now that their family member is dead, which is compelling testimony, but it ain't evidence of anything. They buried all the video of the attack and released one still frame from the same side of the street as the building down the street of the truck driving by, or stopped at the red light. Great job, guys. And yet the juror explained on 60 Minutes that, well, you know, I kept expecting during the defense case for someone to come and say it couldn't have been McVay because he was with me that day. You got the wrong guy. And that just never happened. And so what she's saying is, she sat through the prosecution's entire case. And they never placed him at the scene of the crime. They never said, they never really tried to prove that he was the one who did it. In actual fact. Oh yeah, you know, he got his thumbprint on a receipt for some fertilizer, we claim, and some stuff like that. They never really tried to place him at the scene of the crime. So what does the juror do? The juror does what you would expect anybody's mom to do in the same situation. She's just somebody's mom up there. She doesn't know, you know? I don't mean to sound sexist or something, like demeaning or whatever, but I'm saying she's just some regular lady. She's the school librarian or something. She doesn't know. So she does her best with her cognitive dissonance, and she flips the whole thing around. Presume guilt and put the burden of proof on the defendant to show that it couldn't have been him. He has to prove his innocence instead of the deal, which is you're presumed innocent and the burden is on them to prove that you did it, right? Like, I was one of the few. This surprised the hell out of me. I couldn't figure this out, why this was so difficult for people to comprehend. But back during that stupid OJ thing, which I probably did not pay attention to that at all the whole time it was going on. Come on, man. Can't you tell when they're waving a big red flag in front of your big dumb ox eyes? But anyway, at the end of that thing, I mean, you couldn't help but know something about it. At the end of that thing, I was one of the ones saying, maybe one of the only ones saying, look, obviously he did it, but obviously he should be acquitted. Because the contest in the court isn't whether he did it or not. The contest is whether the government can prove beyond a doubt that he did it or not. And if they can't prove beyond a doubt that he did it or not, then you gotta let him go. Even if you know he did it. Because you know he did it isn't good enough. They have to prove it. Or he's gotta walk. And then if you don't like that, huh, sorry, it's a democracy. The best you can do is vote for a new district attorney to hire some new assistant district attorneys. Good luck with your stupid democracy there. But that's the price you pay for being lousy at it. You get inept prosecutors who can't prove a very guilty guy guilty. And of course, the cops had completely destroyed the crime scene and whatever. It was a pretty hard to prosecute case at that point, I guess. But anyway. But jurors, man, they will bend over backwards. The same thing, I remember the Branch Davidians was another important trial to me, was the trial of the surviving Branch Davidians. And the San Antonio jury was 10-2 for acquittal. We gotta let these people go. They were attacked. Simple as that. If anybody's guilty, as the ATF is guilty. Give me a break. But there were two on that jury who were like, no way, man. I watch Law and Order every night, and my cousin's a cop, and I love police. Oh, I listen to talk radio all day, and I just love them so much. And so we gotta do something to them, even if you're not going to convict them of murder. And so they compromised and found them guilty of using a firearm in the commission of the felony that they had acquitted them of. The felony they were charged with was murder and conspiracy to commit murder. They were acquitted of those, but found guilty on the firearms charge. Well, the judge said, well, I'm throwing out the firearms charge,
and I guess I'm letting them go. Because you can't find them guilty of using a firearm in the commission of a felony that you acquit them for. But then, over the weekend, somebody changed his mind. And he said, no, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sentence them as though you found them guilty of using a firearm in the commission of the felony. Because, after all, or as though you found them guilty of murder. Because, after all, you did rule that they used the firearm in the commission of a felony. What felony? Murder. That's what you meant to say. Murder. And so here it was 10-2 to let them go. But then they were sentenced as though they had been convicted of murder at the end. Because they compromised for the government worshipers on the jury. Who, you know, weren't content with seeing the government come and burn these people's family to death. And shoot them and shoot at them. But anyway, so, you know, I wouldn't trust a jury. That scares the hell out of me. 12, as, you know, like Bill Hicks talking about the movie focus groups, it's the same thing. A dozen random yahoos get to decide. You know, remember after 9/11, those stories about how the conviction rates across the country soared. Oh, yeah, right, because your local detective became a lot more honest player, and his evidence became that much more solid after 9/11, huh? But nah, just because after their greatest failure, the American people were inspired to love government more than ever before. After all, what are you going to do? Replace it with a different one or none? So, they're the only government you have, so love it a lot. There you go. It let you down big, but let's not hold that against them. Yeah. Anyway. And you know, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to ask Will about so many other great articles that he's been writing. One is about the cops who just said, we don't have time for this, and then shot a kid to death. Over what, he was in a hurry? This kid who, the cops who were already there had a handle. This one's coming out at Lou Rockwell tomorrow. For police, murder is a time-saving device. Will Grigg at LouRockwell.com. And then also at Pro Libertate, he has great coverage of this judge who is just as guilty as hell in an OxyContin smuggling ring, the kind that would get you 25 years. Your cousin, 40. Your little sister, 15 years in prison. For dealing drugs like this this judge in, I think it's in Utah. Ward is her name. Judge Virginia Ward. She got the slap on the wrist because she's a judge. She's made in the mob that is the state posing as your security force. Outlawing things like the drugs they like to abuse when they feel like it. But anyway, break's coming up. When we come back, I still got NSA stuff to cover for you. And did you see the COINTELPRO news there? About, remember the story? It's almost a folktale now. In Media, Pennsylvania, some mysterious group of lefties broke into the FBI office and liberated documents about J. Edgar Hoover's counterintelligence program. And in fact, it wasn't even about that. It only had the clue, the keyword COINTELPRO in there, and then later reporters sued on Freedom of Information Act and found out more. But that was the start of it. Well, they're profiled now in the New York Times. I think somebody's written a book about them. And the statute of limitations is up, and so now they're telling their story. The heroes who exposed COINTELPRO. Isn't that cool? Read about it at Reason. They got a great write-up at Reason.com. We'll be right back after this, y'all.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. For some reason, I keep thinking that I want to use this song for bumper music, but I really don't. I don't really like it. It's kind of catchy the first time I heard it or something. And Mike Watt, he's all right, yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, so welcome back to the show. Yes, I need to work out a week or two's worth of bumper music. Yes, I need to get some new spots recorded. One for Cash Into Coins, my new sponsor, but also for everybody's already a sponsor. FFF and CNI and Wall Street Window and the War State and Liberty Stickers and all of those, they need new spots. I'm sorry, guys. I know they must be driving you mad by now, the same ones playing over and over. I need to get Tom Woods to make a new Liberty Classroom spot for me, too. But my advertisers, I owe them that. Fresh new spots. I swear I'll try to get to it as soon as I can. Actually, it's kind of time-consuming. See, my thing is, I figure if I edit it, it won't sound right. I gotta just nail the whole thing in one shot. And then I find error after error, and I try to, you know, fix it up and fix it up and fix it up and fix it up. And then I gotta get it in one take, the whole thing, or else I gotta start over. Very picky. And it can take friggin' forever to cut a 30-second spot if you're me. But one of these days or nights or something, I'm going to get it done. I promise. New spots, everybody. And maybe I'm too old to come up with new bumper music anymore. I don't know. I think I am. Okay. Hey, let's talk about NSA stuff. Oh, wait. Here's a gun control story. Chicago ban on gun sales within city struck down by judge. That's good news. He must have recognized the fact that he didn't have a choice. That's the law. You see, here's what happens when somebody passes an amendment to the Constitution. Like, say, for example, the 13th Amendment, which bans slavery and empowers Congress to pass legislation to the end of enforcing the end of slavery. Then what that means is that amendment overrides anything that was ever written in any other part of the Constitution if it comes into conflict. That's what it means to be an amendment. And so the Second Amendment says that the people have the right to bear arms. It recognizes that fact and proscribes the government from violating that right. Of course, they get away with bloody murder on each and every one of the Bill of Rights, but certainly something as blatant as a city banning a shop from selling guns is a violation, in effect, of the Second Amendment. Same thing as if they just, you know, try to find a technicality and tax them out of existence or something like that. No. You're violating the right of the people of Chicago to be able to have access to guns. And I think it'll be for the best. I've never been to Chicago. I'm not from there. I don't think that it's going to lead to more war among gangs. I think it'll probably lead to less, and certainly it'll lead to less overall crime. There's just no doubt about that. Come on. Jeez, that guy may or may not have a gun. Maybe or maybe I shouldn't pull my knife on him. You see, you could be really dumb and still know better. So, anyway, and besides, you know what? Regardless of whether, you know, it's a policy you prefer or not, the people of Chicago have the right to buy guns. And so, no matter how badly you disagree with it, it's a moot point. Might as well be shouting about how much you like a Star Trek movie or something. I don't care. It doesn't have nothing to do with nothing. You don't have the right to tell them they don't have the right. See? Simple. Good. I like talking about good news every once in a while. There is some good news every once in a while. All right, now Nick Terse. Man, that guy's hard to get on the radio show. And you know what? He ain't really the best interview, but man, he writes great journalism, and I think it's really important. If you look at Tom Dispatch today, certainly it'll be at antiwar.com tomorrow. May already be there, I don't know. Nick Terse has this great new update, write-up, about the Special Operations Command and the Joint Special Operations Command and how they're the military within the military, the super extra secret military within the military, and how
they're setting up their own combatant commands across the world. And how they're deployed in somewhere between 80 and 120 countries or so. Maybe more. There's only 190-something, depending on the day of the week, countries in the world. 192 or 96 or something. So I'm going to try to get Nick Turse on. Of course, he's the author of the great book, Kill Anything That Moves. The real history of America's war in Vietnam, which I highly suggest you take a look at. Man, oh man, is that something. And it's all just government documents. It's all his investigation of army investigations of army war crimes. It's not like he's sitting around with a grudge making up stuff. This is all out of the National Archives. Boxes of files that Nick Turse found that no one else had ever looked for before. That he wasn't looking for. That he stumbled across. And then devoted years of work to. It's really something. You really should look at it. It's Kill Anything That Moves. Based on army documents investigating their own war crimes in Vietnam. I want to get him on, but even if I can't get him on the show, I think you should look at antiwar.com, look at tomdispatch.com, and read his write-up about the Joint Special Operations Command. Well, and just the Special Operations Command. And, you know, he doesn't get too much into the distinction there. There is one, but what the hell do I know? I don't know. I want to know more about that distinction, such as it is. I guess it's just the JSOC is the top, top tier, right? That's what they say. All right, and then let me see here. I wanted to, just a brief mention here. Most in the country now, majority, think that pot should be legal. 55% say legalized pot. And I'll just say this about this. You know what I think this represents? It's a generational change. But here's what makes the difference in the generational change. It's not that the baby boomers are any less totalitarian. They're very totalitarian. They're totally totalitarian. They're a bunch of jerks. All he is. But here's the thing. They actually have experience with pot. Whereas their parents were just, wear pot. Because they heard on TV that it's scary and dangerous. They don't know the first thing about it. I mean, there are people. There's an entire generation and more in the country who have no experience with pot. And the difference now is people actually have smoked some before. And, you know, if it's somebody else's idea to legalize it, they're going, okay, well, what the hell, I care. It doesn't make that much difference. And yeah. So that's good. A little bit of reality finally getting through. It's a generational change more than anything, I guess. And then who would have thought this? The government loses money on their drug war? All those probation fines? Jeez, you guys are bad at accounting. I would have thought it was a giant cash cow for the state, and that was, I mean, and not just from what they take from you and the name from it, but all the money they make, all the property they seize, and all the fines and fees. Oh. But no, they lose money on the drug war by the bazillions. And so more and more of the state governments in a recession are going, man, we raise our property taxes anymore. They might, I don't know, cry or something. Not going to do anything about it, but we don't want to hear them cry anymore. So, yeah, let's go ahead and legalize weed. We'll save. In California, they're estimating they're going to save $600 million a year if they legalize pot, which is, I forget, I think it's a ballot measure there. Of course, in Colorado, they legalized weed, and great. All it means is less money wasted, less rights violated. More people getting high and getting along with each other, and it's good for all the local food establishments of all descriptions. And what's the big deal? Like Bill Hicks said, so what, you're smoking pot and you're getting a wreck. You're only going 5 miles an hour. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Huh, thought it mattered. So we must be living in the future if people's minds are really changing about this. And laws are finally really changing about this, so. And, you know, there's a little bit of a mini scandal over the weekend, I guess, or Monday or Friday or something about
David Brooks in the New York Times wrote, yeah, I used to smoke pot, but I think all in all, it's more or less pretty bad for people or something. So I think it should still be illegal. And completely, of course, completely ignoring that making it illegal is not just Uncle Sam sending a message. You're destroying people's lives. You're getting people killed. You're getting people locked up with actual real criminal killers. You're making people participate in dangerous black markets. You're doing it wrong. You're hurting people with your stupid message sending. God, to be a moderate Republican in this day and age is just, you've got to be such a damned heel, you know? You got to be David Brooks in the brain to just sit there and pretend that you are not crushing people's very lives with your stupid little policies. Oh, man, I think, you know, more or less, we're better off if people smoke it less, so let's keep it a crime. Well, geez, how about you just turn us all upside down, hold us by our ankles, and shake the last coins out of our pockets, and spend it on a great, I don't know, Karen Hughes, Condoleezza Rice propaganda campaign so that people understand why they should choose not to smoke it. How about you do that? Instead of getting people killed in your little sociology experiment. Conservatives, they're such commies, aren't they? Oh, I want to use the state to order society my way, which makes me the exact opposite of the people who want to order it a little bit differently than me. Yeah, sure does. Conservatives, dangerous. All right, y'all, thanks for putting up with me. Thanks for listening to the show. This is the Scott Horton Show. We'll be back tomorrow and hopefully have some great journalists on to talk about their great journalism about America's evil imperial foreign policy. If you like that. Oh, I was going to talk about the NSA. The NSA is bad.